Well, hey, this is Dave. How's everybody doing?
Hi, Dave. This is Janine. How are you?
Welcome. Hey, thanks for all the help. You've made it really easy and really fun to do it. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Likewise.
If we have early arrivals, I'll be happy to take questions and have a conversation. There are a couple of sets of questions that I've gotten by email that I want to address in a direct mode right after the top of the hour. But I'll take anything before and after that. But there's a cluster of a couple of things that I really want to respond to that are terrific points that I'll be happy to do that.
Okay. So you'd like to do that when we stop at the top of the hour to take those questions that you got through email?
To be sure that the people who sent those in are present.
Okay. Thank you.
Until then, any thoughts or comments or questions from anyone?
Yeah, I can see there's a few people on the call. We have Nancy Formella, and I think maybe is it Catherine Lentieri?
Kathy Lentieri.
Hi there.
Well, you've got the dashboard down. and Nancy led one of the sets of questions
yes.
that I wanted to respond to right after the top of the hour. If there are none now, I'll do it. But I'm eager to hear thoughts or questions or input. You're halfway through. You're half as smart as you're going to be. So is this what you expected? And are there things that you particularly want to highlight or point out or ask about? Go ahead. I think I talked over someone.
Yeah, Dave, this is Kathy, and I'm really delighted to be attending in person because of meetings. I've had to listen to what you presented in the replay. And as a fellow psychiatrist, and there aren't too many coaches that are fellow psychiatrists, it's really a pleasure to hear your thoughts and your experience in this. And my question is, as you were talking about the presentation to the Institute and how you presented it in a way that you felt drew people in by limiting the number, I was also wondering how you thought about the topic itself, because I just have a feeling that there's also something in the way you step back and conceive of what people are interested in that might have had a part in that.
I think that's a part of it, too. I didn't focus on that, but it was, and it's great to hear a fellow shrink. Are you still practicing, or have you also made a total transition to mentor coaching?
Just a few hours a week.
Okay.
I'm doing executive coaching around the country.
I found it really easy to do a wholesale transition in that way. There was no question, and it made it really easy. Mm-hmm. I think the topic also is important because the topic was avant-garde in the field at that point of self-psychology, because, as you know, self-psychology was a new area that really kind of blossomed in the 80s that people who were not treatable before were now treatable by therapy and analysis when some basic principles were understood and it wasn't approached in the way that classical analysis was, like the repair manual to a Model T, but really some very current thinking and integrating the beginnings, just the whispers of neuroscience then, and how the mind and brain work. So that, of course, appealed to me. And much of what we're talking about now has been in the last 2 or 3 years. So things have evolved significantly. And are evolving at a really exciting way. Now, Kathy, does that answer your question?
Well, my question was actually just kind of to the side of what the topic you were talking about, which was the motivating people to come in by using the limitation in space. I was just also wondering how you think about what your audience wants to hear and you decide to talk about, I guess, anything.
Okay. I'm specifically going to talk about that and give an example today that will elaborate a little bit more. You know, we talked just in an introductory way about drawing a circle. In that circle, draw a stick figure. That's your client or your potential audience or your potential customer. And how do you get in that circle? That's what we're going to talk more about today. So that's a great question.
Thank you.
And I appreciate that. And if we need to talk more about it, come back on after I give an example. Also, after the top of the hour, some of you asked for more examples or a brief case study, and I have something that brings that together in a way that I think will be fun. But since it is the top of the hour, do we want to be official now?
Sure. Yeah, I think we should get started. Dave, are you okay?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks, everyone, and welcome. This is Janine DeLay from ICF New England, and I'm from the Professional Development Committee. We put on webinars and live events like this to help with your continuing education. Really happy to be with you tonight, and I'll be moderating the session with Dave. This is the third of four sessions. I know many of you have attended already. And I won't give you a big introduction with Dave because you've already had that. I do want to give you some reminders about how we'll run the call tonight. The session is being recorded, and it will be made available to you 24 to 48 hours after the session on the learning page. I will be muting your phones if you are not Dave and not presenting tonight, but there will be a question and answer period midway through the session. We'll pause. And if you'd like to queue up to ask a question, you can do so by pressing *5 on your telephone. Again, that's *5, and then I'll be able to see who's in line to ask a question. I'll call on you and unmute your phone. You can ask your question, and then Dave will respond.
So you hear there's a new sheriff in town. this is probably my fault because I didn't introduce Janine to this aspect of the telebridge earlier. And just by simply asking to watch the background noise wasn't enough, but you guys are doing a great job right now, and I appreciate that. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Janine.
Yes. Thank you, Dave. And Dave, are you willing to stay a few minutes after the hour as you have in the past, maybe 10 or 15 minutes for any follow-up questions?
Yeah, let's set 10 minutes and then let's do a halftime, and I'll probably be a little more aware to do it closer to the true halftime this time so that we can catch up with any questions or comments just briefly at a midpoint. Okay?
Excellent.
Do that again?
Sure, that sounds great.
Super.
Okay, I also want to let folks know that Dave is open to your emails for questions that don't get covered in tonight's session. So if you could take Dave's email down, it's dkruger, K-R-U-E-G-E-R, @mentorpath.com. dkruger@mentorpath.com. And Dave's been hearing from you, getting your feedback and getting your questions, and you can continue to do that as we move through these sessions. And so I'll turn it over to Dave for tonight's session on Mastery Mindset Development.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thanks to all of you for your kind words and follow-up. I wanted to comment on a couple of areas, particularly one that sort of clustered around an initial email from Nancy about what we do in coaching that will work in the real world, and wanted me to elaborate about something that I just mentioned sort of in passing last time. This is something that I think is so very important, that we establish a model that our clients download while we're talking about other things. And we're going to talk some in this seminar about how confidence is a state of mind and how states of mind are contagious, how the model that we use, the framework that we use, how we handle it, setting a time, sticking to that, and how all of those things are important. You know, it's sort of like, you know, raising children. we don't know exactly what's going to be remembered and what's going to be most important, so that means that everything is. For example, setting a time. If you set a 50-minute session and then sort of go over 10 or 15 minutes, that model won't work in the real world. If someone has a similar approach to mortgage or credit card payment or rent, well, I just sort of let it go for a while. That won't work. So we need to establish a model that is a framework that works also in the real world, just like parenting. You know, as a parent, you ideally do with your kids what's going to work in the real world. If having a fit and getting what you want works at home, that's not going to work in the real world. So basically, if you want a behavior to continue or enhance, respond to it. Now, another variation of this is, I believe that the most important thing that we can do or be for our clients is to believe in them. We now know from neuroscience that believing in someone actually changes their state of mind as they receive that experience from the person who believes. Let me give you a kind of an example of this that I know works. And I particularly don't like authors who say, well, I call it this, but this is something there was nothing other than to make up a term for it. In science, there are forward truths. We proffer an hypothesis and then look for evidence. But there are reverse truths. One of these is a belief, like a belief in our kids. Our belief in our children is taken in by them and metabolized into their own belief in themselves. And we say this without words to our clients. I'll believe in you until both of us can. Now, here's an illustration of this. Many, many years ago, on the last Father's Day before my son left for college, there was a note at my bathroom sink. And a portion of the letter that he left addressed this reverse truth. He said, Dad, you've never lied to me before. And you told me that you'd never lie to me, and you told me you would believe everything you told me, everything I told you. And it sounded stupid at first, but I've never lied to you, and as time passed, it became more important, and I realized that I never would. You believing in me was a relationship few others have ever had. So, a belief is something we live into. It's not a conclusion that we reach. So, it's one of the important things, I believe, the most important thing that we do in working with a client, and I won't work with a client unless I believe them, because then they'll teach us, that the client will teach us both why. So that, I believe, is really important because it's conveyed. It's not conveyed in words, in language, or in logical and conscious ways, but yet it's very, very real. So, Nancy, does that answer your question about elaborating a little bit more about what we do in coaching and it's going to have an impact in the real world?
Yes, Dave, that helps a lot. I appreciate that.
Okay. We establish a model of how and who someone can hope to be. Another example is we set professional fees that make the exchange worthy and offers a model of how somebody can respond. Let me tell you just a brief example. Also, many years ago, there was a patient in psychoanalysis who responded to the usual framework I had, as I indicate at the beginning of the year, if I will adjust my fees on the basis of inflation, and I announced to everyone in this particular December that I'd raise my fees $5 a month beginning January. And I told everyone this. There was one person who I was a little bit reluctant because she was another professional in analysis, and she was just starting her practice. And I announced to her, as I did everyone else, and there was a long pause, and I just knew something was going on. And she said, "Damn it, Kruger, if you can't say to me, you're going to increase my fee," in the same calm, sure, confident voice that you say everything else, "how in the world do you expect that I'm going to go out there and get what I'm worth? Now, would you like to try that again?" And I knew she was right, and I said it again. And she said, "Thank you. Now let's get on with my analysis." Just another example. One other thing I want to get to is some of you have asked for more examples or a brief case study for the principles of influence and persuasion and for the beginning tools of neuromarketing. Here's one of the best application I could find that combines a number of these. So, as you listen to this, see how many of the elements that we've discussed in the first two seminars you can identify. Jot them down as you hear them. Tom Sawyer's whitewashing a fence under strict orders from his Aunt Polly. A neighborhood kid named Ben walks by, teasing Tom of his afternoon plans. Ben said, "Say, I'm going swimming. Don't you wish you could? But of course you'd rather work, wouldn't you? Of course you would." Tom contemplated the boy a bit, and he said, "What do you call work?" "Why, ain't that work?" Tom resumed his whitewashing and answered carelessly, "Well, maybe it is, maybe it ain't. All I know, it suits Tom Sawyer." "Oh, come on now. You don't mean you like that and let on like you really like it?" The brush continued to move. "Like it? Well, I don't see why I oughtn't to like it. Doesn't a boy get a chance to whitewash a fence every day? No way." That put the thing in a new light. Ben stopped nibbling his apple. Tom swept his brush daintily back and forth, stepped back to note the effect, added a touch here and there, criticized the effect again, Ben watching every move and getting more and more interested, more and more absorbed. Presently, he said, "Say, Tom, let me whitewash a little." Tom considered. He was about to consent, but he altered his mind. "No, no. I reckon it wouldn't hardly do, Ben. You see, Aunt Polly's awful particular about this fence, right here on the street, you know. But if it was the back fence, I wouldn't mind and she wouldn't. Yeah, she's awful particular about this fence. It's got to be done very careful. I reckon there ain't one boy in 1,000, maybe 2,000, that could do it the way it's got to be done." You know what happens next. Ben is ignited, setting off a contagion of desire that ends with Tom happily observing as the neighborhood kids barter and beg for the chance to whitewash the fence in his stead. So here are the essential elements of influence and persuasion Tom incorporates. Liking. Obviously, Tom is a likable guy. Most obvious that he likes himself. Scarcity. He moves from liking, relatedness, and connection quickly to scarcity, emphasizing his autonomy and certainty. He demonstrates his mindset of enjoyment. He speaks and acts committed and consistent. He embodies reciprocity from his position of authority. The contagion of social proof frames the conversation. And Tom definitely is an expert at managing the state of others, beginning with himself, then Ben, then the legion of whitewashers. Each now belongs to a new, highly motivated group to engage in a meaningful endeavor. So that's the best condensed case I could find. So any other questions or comments just briefly before we move into our material? Well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode then and jot down anything, and we'll do a brief halftime. You see in the outline for this seminar the Mindset Mastery Quiz. Carnegie Mellon did a large study to determine the major factor for professionals earning the trust of others. Which do you think of these four was most important? Established, proven expert, confidence of the professional, demonstrated current expertise, and reputation. Mindset is simply a set of assumptions and beliefs that determines how we perceive, process, and behave. It's analogous to the software program of each state of mind. Our mindsets consciously and unconsciously determine our choices. Elite athletes know how to get themselves in an optimum state before going on the court or field and how to sustain it. Masterful actors, speakers, and storytellers do as well. Getting in state is mental, emotional, and physical. And that's what I want to talk about in terms of what you do professionally. A significant persuasion and leadership competency is self-regulation and self-management. Knowing your own skills and deploying them effectively in a mindset specifically matched to the task. So, consider this. How do you get a potential prospect you may not know or don't even see in a state of mind to consider your service or product? This is a question a number of you had for those initial questions about what was the one question you'd like to ask. How do you do that? How do you do that from a website? How do you do that when someone calls you? The next time you want someone to get on board with your idea or service, simply tell a story where you spell out the best outcome. We know now from the mind and brain sciences that storytelling is the most powerful way to plant ideas into someone's mind. Stories are how we make sense of things, how we remember. Stories engage emotionally and explain logically. When we're being told an effective story, it activates not only the language processing areas, but also the areas used in experiencing the events of the story. Someone tells us how delicious a peach is, our sensory cortex lights up. When it's about emotion, our right neocortex gets active. When the story character grabs an object, motor neurons activate. When the character observes a scene, vision-related neurons fire. A story puts the whole brain to work. Go to any bookseller and go to the nonfiction section, whatever your favorite nonfiction section is, even the business section, pick any book that grabs you, and chapter one will begin with a story. Guaranteed, if it's made it to the bookstore, it's going to begin with a very compelling story. Stories affect us mentally as well as physically. Ann Crindle at the Dartmouth Brain Lab showed how viewers' brains resonated with a specific emotion enacted on the screen. When the central character was angry, the viewers' brains registered as well. When the scene was sad, the viewers' brains corresponded. Whenever we feel disgust, that brain region, the anterior insula, fires. We sense the other person's intentions and imagine what an experience means in his or her mind. Mind sight. Our innate ability to see into each other's minds relies on attunement of empathic resonance with another's subjective experience, emotionally and cognitively. The teller's state of mind and intention is key to the listener's reception or readers. For example, if we sense the other person is phony or distracted, we automatically distance or tune out. When someone genuinely attunes, it enhances the inclination to reciprocate. This means that getting in state needs to be before you engage your reader or listener. Relax your body, control your breath, get solidly grounded to access the optimum state of mind for a particular task. The primary reason to get in state is to concentrate your energy on a full, undisturbed immersion in your engagement. Remember, people like, respect, trust, and are influenced by those who have the ability to remain calm and thoughtful. Tom Sawyer. This default setting to remain centered and grounded no matter what becomes an essential success paradigm. Like any state of mind, it's contagious, amygdala to amygdala, midbrain to midbrain. Regulating your own state of mind in a sustained way is the most effective influence on someone else to do the same. So here are four principles, the mindset tools of persuasion. And I want to discuss these, and we'll do these basically for the remainder of the seminar. The context, remember, is authenticity. It's the most valuable gift you have to offer is yourself. First mindset tool, persuasion. Rapport. For a long-term impact, establish authentic, caring, and emotional investment. Remember the three story elements? Challenge, development, resolution. First, ask what you can do for them. Remember the persuasion principle of reciprocity. Highlight mutual interest, the persuasion tool of relatedness. Tell a story that solves a challenge. Two, ask questions. Redirect the focus from problems to possibilities. That's what we do as coaches, appreciative inquiry. Move to a mindset of openness, exploration. Remember, the focus determines the state of mind. So paint a picture of a positive outcome. When people imagine, it becomes real for them. Three, personal congruity. What you say verbally and non-verbally have to match. That personal congruity is essential. The person who feels the most certain is the greatest influencer. And four, state management of yourself and to impact emotions and state of mind of the prospect. And remember, we talked before, people don't buy products, they buy states. So let's talk about now the difference between success and failure. The two most important determinants of success, beliefs and state management. Let's look at both of these. Belief is the blueprint, the software of the unconscious mind. And that's why I felt non-hesitant about giving the personal example and talking about belief as a part of the answer to the question about what do we convey, what works in the real world, what works in coaching earlier. So belief is the mind's command to the brain. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain, and repeated focus rewires the brain. This is the way belief becomes an anatomical reality. Beliefs then determine what we do or won't do. What we believe, the meaning we feel certain will come from situations, determines how we behave and what we'll do. Social neuroscientists show us that we have to believe in what we're selling or we won't sell. So how can you create a new belief? The oak sleeps in the acorn. Success comes to those who become success conscious. Failure enhances when there's focus on the negative or focus on problems. The only method of voluntary conscious development of belief is repetitions of affirmations to your unconscious. We come to believe what we repeat to ourselves, whether it's true or false. If a lie is repeated, it ultimately is experienced as the truth. The teller even ultimately can't tell the difference. This neuroscience principle emphasizes the need and power of positive focus. Visions are the seedlings of reality. If you can't see significant wealth in your imagination and your vision, you won't see it in your bank account. Systematic, repeated visualization rewires the brain. Affirmations are stories that support the visualizations to revise mind software. You're not ready for something until you believe you can acquire it. Belief can be inscribed by affirmation or repeated instructions to the unconscious mind. Repetition of affirmations to your unconscious is a powerful method of voluntary development of belief. Any thought that is repeatedly passed on to the unconscious mind is finally accepted. This is as true for wealth accumulation as it is for other consistent repetitions, such as crime. Now, I'm not talking about magic here, but I'm talking about a positive belief that channels energy into a strategic plan. People will say yes much more readily to your belief than to your information or technical sales skill. So the first sell is to yourself. Selling is transference of emotion. You must feel certain to make someone believe. The primary way you convince someone else is if you're convinced. You will transfer whatever state of mind you're in, doubt or confidence. And people, amazingly, even when they don't seem to be as consciously attuned to themselves, they can pick up 99% versus 100% commitment or confidence. The second difference between success and failure, state management. So the everyday application is to recognize and understand emotional couplings. Regardless of how logical we think we are, our first register of a new stimulus is emotional. Emotions travel faster to brain decision center than rational thoughts. Any new input goes directly to the amygdala in our midbrain. Then the hippocampus attaches meaning, and then it goes to the forebrain to process consciously and intellectually, in other words, to make logical sense. Now, a footnote here, the hippocampus is the primary location of the unconscious, where meanings are attached. This is why what someone associates to you and to your company is so important. Our state of mind, the software package, determines the meaning we attach to a stimulus, and the meaning attached determines the behavior. And remember, each state of mind is like an autonomous software package. It contains its own beliefs, associations, and sets of experience. Think about it this way. You're at home relaxing after dinner with your partner, having a glass of wine, a great conversation. There's a noise in the backyard. You likely don't notice it, or if you do, you dismiss it. The next evening, you're home alone, just after watching Criminal Minds, and you hear the same noise. You're alert to it. You're vigilant. You check it out. Same stimulus, but the state of mind determined the meaning that you attach. The meaning you attach determines your behavior. Everything at the lower emotional brain and the midbrain are unconscious processes. We're not aware of them. The emotional activation registered before cognitive areas of the brain come into play to assess options. Neuroeconomics research demonstrates that we make decisions, especially purchase decisions, up to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware. So, this is the order it happens. Once we unconsciously make an emotional commitment to a yes or to a no decision, these lower brain structures send the conscious mind on a mission to gather all the logical reasons to support that decision. We then cherry-pick data to support that pre-selected belief. Remember the boomerang effect that I talked about at the beginning of last seminar. We find something logical and sensible for it to light on, even if it's not an accurate cause and effect. The rationalization becomes a confirmation bias. We inhabit the story we want to believe. The failure to notice contradictory data then becomes an inattentional blindness, unless we become aware of it, which we do in coaching and with our clients. But I'm saying this for the backdrop of mindset, and especially with application to marketing. When we make a choice, we couple memory from past experiences with the best guesses of a likely future. Our lives are determined by our choices. Those choices are informed by what we focus on and shaped by the meaning that we attribute. So, a part of the brain that anticipates pleasant outcomes, the nucleus accumbens, activates a buy decision. In fact, anticipating a purchase triggers dopamine. A don't buy decision originates in a different part of the brain, insula, an area involved in anticipating pain. So, look at what happens here. Credit cards decouple buying, the activation of the pleasure center, and paying, the activation of the pain center. The pleasure, the purpose, is segmented from the pain of future payment. This segmentation renders repayment a future event and an abstraction. So, we purchase at least 23% more when we do it by credit card than by cash or check. So that's why it's hard to save for the future, because the future is an abstraction. And that 27-inch iMac or that strawberry cheesecake is a right-now pleasure. So let's talk a little bit about regulating states of mind. I want to refer you to the it's about a 35-minute webinar at the very center of my homepage of MentorPath, and it's about regulating states of mind. So I'm just going to focus on some highlights here and refer you to that, but emphasize some things that I think are applicable to our focus. Your state of mind, a particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to any stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. The two primary ways to regulate your state of mind: focus and physiology. Physiology is how you use your body, your biochemistry, such as relaxation or deep breathing or meditation. Focus is what and how you direct your conscious attention. From quantum physics and brain science, you get what you focus on, not what you want. Focus aligns your energy field. Now, the questions we ask determine what we focus on. Questions direct the focus, so they can also determine the state we're in. And this is why questions are so very important in the work that we do. But let me give you a very quick example. I was asked to do a workshop at a Vistage group, and the Vistage chair, a buddy of mine, indicated that two of her members, one a CEO and another a business owner, had experienced challenging incidents at their companies. Both had involved really tragic accidents, and how each of them had responded is they were totally preoccupied with this, and it was affecting them, their work, and this was for one about 3 months and another about 4.5 months after, and they were still having doubts, and it was impacting them, their executive team, and their company. So I suggested this exercise. Sometime before you go to bed, write down three questions that would create a positive, powerful state of mind. And as soon as you wake up in the morning, before your feet ever touch the floor, answer those questions. Feel the answer to each of the three questions so that you are in an empowered, positive state. For example, what will I create today that will be more powerful than I ever dreamed of? And they each indicated that that was the first thing they thought of every morning is, what can go wrong today? Will I be able to handle it? The feedback I got, in less than a week, both executives created a positive turnaround in focus, attitude, and engagement for themselves and their organizations. And I explained, we're always asking questions of ourselves. As we wake up, we're asking questions, even before we're consciously aware of it, about what's going to happen that day. Are we going to be able to do it? To look ahead and ask questions. So asking effective questions determines a state of mind. This is your power of focus. The best mentors, leaders, and teachers are the ones who ask the best questions to get us to use our own resources. The first application, to yourself. Next, to your client, in that order. So here's a mindset formula for optimizing persuasion. The difference between a professional and an amateur, between massive success or less, is the ability to manage your state of mind to achieve and sustain a peak performance state. So find the challenge or the problem of your client, the deep want or interest that is unfulfilled. Show prospects how to solve the problem or meet the challenge. Associate positive consequences if they do. Look at what negative consequences they come up with if they don't. This mindset of persuasion associates buying with getting pleasure, not buying with pain. Remember, people will do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure. This is risk aversion. This is why the focus on results and positive consequences becomes way more effective. And remember this, the primary reason we do what we do is how we imagine we'll feel when we do it. The persuasion process is centered on getting your prospect to clearly associate the most desired feeling or state with your product or service. The three primary reasons someone fails to persuade: not consistently managing mindset. And this is often the difference between success and failure. No compelling purpose during a challenging time, and limiting beliefs such as, I don't think this is going to work. I've tried it before. I don't think I can do it. Of the insights that neuroscience brings to the business world, one of the most powerful is the ability to understand how a consumer connects various concepts about your brand at an unconscious level. And this is really going to be the subject of the next seminar on neuromarketing. It's crucially important to have a clear and exact understanding of the individual elements that make up the existing unconscious perceptions of a product or service. People love people who change their state. That's why entertainers are paid so much more than educators, pro athletes more than service people. We want to be around people who change our state for the better. Let's apply that to your business. Your state of mind will have emotional contagion. Manage your state because it induces a state in others. You associate positive or negative emotion to your services or product, so does your prospect. If you're not in a peak state, such as a down feeling or a lesser expectation, that will also be emotionally contagious. Authentic energy is contagious. When your story truly excites you and you let that confidence show, it will be infectious to prospects. Your authenticity of genuine enthusiasm and conviction will resonate with prospects. So here's a kind of a sidebar question. Why can someone who begins at a peak state with a prospect come across as hyper or like a typical salesperson and turn the prospect off? The answer, they don't begin where their prospect is. Remember, the first step is to resonate with the challenge, to empathically resonate, become attuned to the experience of the client, especially the challenge, and find a way to communicate that experience. The result co-creates a common ground, a reciprocal connection. Then the client or prospect will go somewhere new with you, to follow your lead to arrive stepwise at the same place. So consider these questions for your reflection, and then we're going to do a break for any clarifications or questions. How much money, how many prospects have you lost because you haven't been in a peak state in the last 3 months, in the last 3 years? How much did it cost you emotionally? Regret, pain, less energy, less money, of not being in a peak state in the last 3 months, in the last 3 years. In the next 10 years, what will it cost you if you don't master this ability? In the next 10 years, what will you operate at a peak state and enjoy the process while you're doing it? Selling is a transference of emotion. You associate your state to your product or service. People associate your state to your product or service. People buy a state. State change is activating. So, here's a summary of the mindset management principles. State is what you're selling more than a product or service. Selling is influencing the prospect's focus, the value, the benefits, the pleasure, and to avoid pain. Questions determine what we focus on in the state we're in. The mindset of self-reflection fosters thoughtfulness, depth, and wisdom. So match your optimum state of mind to the specific task. Anchor yourself for success. Peak performance comes from being in a peak state. It may be focus and physiology, a focus phrase and a deep breath, or by a brief relaxation meditation. Remember, your optimum state for some things, like a presentation, may be to energize yourself, to create optimism. For other things, like working with a client, it may be to get fully centered and grounded. to go to sleep more effectively, it may be a full relaxation. The key is to effectively enter the optimum state for a particular task. I want to do a brief break and then come back and talk about confidence as a state of So, we're in conversation mode. Thoughts, questions, anybody?
If you have a question, please press star 5 and I'll call on you.
If we don't have a question or clarification, I'll go back on lecture mode, and I'll be sure that we preserve some time at the end. Final call for any questions or comments. Okay.
Let's see. Oh. Dave?
Yes.
Can you hear me, Dave? Okay, we've got a couple of questions coming in here.
Oh, okay.
All right. We've got somebody, last phone number, 4 digits is 1416. Can you please go ahead?
Yeah, I sure can. Thanks so much.
I'm
going to try to make this clear, but, you know, we're talking about, you know, changing the emotional state. And, you know, when somebody's really focused on something that's making them unhappy, and you kind of go through a different way to look at things and from a place that will make them less stressed. And they believe all those things, or I shouldn't say they believe all those things, with their head, they believe all those things, but emotionally, they can't attach to those things at all. You know, how do you get them past being so stuck in this emotional negative state and get them to actually attach emotions to the more positive thoughts? Does that make sense?
Okay, it does. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can.
Okay. I think this is a good example of focus, and it's a great example of what we do in coaching that is unique to coaching, because we look at now and next, at possibility rather than problems. So instead of joining that client in a state of mind, and consider when you talk about being unhappy and in that negative state, that is a state of mind. And
yeah,
what will be most useful for that client is to get grounded and centered in a way that they can consider looking at and focusing with you on possibility. So the regulation of state of mind is the first step. So one simple way is to resonate with the client's experience to indicate that you hear how unhappy the person is or how upset they are, and then once you have created that common ground with that resonance, to look at what possibility that we can learn from this that would be helpful in going forward, or to look at what can be done to get grounded and centered in situations like this. Listen to the webinar. There's a portion of this that answers the question in much more detail. And there's a neural conditioning chart that I welcome you using with your clients. You'll see it on the webinar, because it looks at getting someone to identify the emotional triggers that instantly create that state change, and that's what you're describing, is
yeah,
defined. And in that software program, someone is not going to be able to engage with you to move forward. The first step is they have to get grounded and centered,
mm-hmm,
and then to move into a collaboration with you, or even more ideally, a planned ideal behavior. There's a description of that, about how you move from recognizing the state change instantly to get grounded and centered to move to an ideal behavior. You can't get to an ideal behavior from an altered state, because you're stuck there. It's like
right,
falling in a time capsule.
Right.
To try to understand or reason or logic or feel your way out of it won't work. It's a two-step process. The first step is always getting grounded and centered, and then engaging and looking at ideal behavior. and the client can work at that some on his or her own and some with you. And the use of that chart that you'll see, that's developed and evolved over time, and I call it a neural conditioning chart, because when you move from a usual emotional trigger all the way to an ideal behavior, and you do that consistently, ultimately that will become the default mode.
Yeah, and you know, I find if you can get somebody to lock into the truth of one of those less stressful messages, it's just like a light goes off. But it's hard to get there. So where do I find the neuroconditioning chart?
It's in the Master States of Mind webinar at the very center of my homepage.
Perfect.
And one aspect of that is that whenever someone has that negative message, that negative thought loop that kind of inserts itself as a negative thought, one way of thinking about that is to consider it an error message from your brain. So that this is an example of what's an anatomical reality in the brain, because that's an automatic way of doing it. To think about that as an error message from your brain, which refocuses to looking at what you want to do in an adaptive way here or now, and reframes that from focus on the past and that different state of mind to looking at the present and an immersion in the present, so that it's refocused and reframed as an error message from the brain to exactly what someone can address here and now.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. I'm gonna look at your website as well. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you for that call. Dave, we have one more question. Do we have time for that?
No, for my usual answer, but I'll try to be unusually brief, uncharacteristically brief. Go ahead with the question.
Okay. I think it's Stephanie. Go ahead.
Is it me?
Yeah, I think so.
Because of time, I'm going to hold my question, and I'll ask it at the end so Dr. Kruger can continue.
Tell
me the question so that I can let it marinate.
You can think about it.
Going, and I may accidentally stumble into an answer.
It was in reference to what you were saying about affirmations and beliefs.
Okay.
Do you want me to ask the question?
Just very briefly, as maybe a précis, affirmations are the story that support a visualization. Affirmations are ways of tweaking or adjusting the mind software. Visualizations are a way of rewiring our brain, because the brain can't tell whether you're imagining it or whether you're actually seeing it. So the combination of the two. In fact, I will send, I don't know if this is a burden or not, I tell you what, I can make it easier rather than sending it to Heather or Janine to send around to each of you. I'm going to post on the page that you go to for the playback. I'm going to post two things. One is a chapter on a systematic way of approaching visualization and affirmation. It's from a book of mine called Outsmart Your Brain. And I'm also going to dictate some aspects of what I will go into, what I was going to go into that's actually more boring. So I'm going to dictate from the outline that I have that you're looking at too, and post that so that you'll have that so we can talk about some more interesting stuff. If that's the deal, we'll proceed. So
thank you, Dave. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Super. Thanks. Now, I want to... I think I'm on lecture mode, but it doesn't sound like it. The new sheriff has more power than I thought she had. Okay.
I think you're okay. Go ahead.
Okay, great. All right, thanks. Now, I want to talk about confidence as a state of mind. We know from numerous neuroscience studies that emotions and states of mind are contagious by an energy field transfer from midbrain to midbrain, person to person. Einstein referred to this as the unified field theory. He emphasized that we are each a bundle of energy and interact with another person who's also a bundle of energy, and those energy fields intersect and interact. The same with each person and the collective energy field of a group of other people. This happens in the same way by telephone that it does as it does face to face. Confident is a state of mind. People naturally associate confidence with expertise. The induction of a shared experience, a mutual influence of energy fields, plays a role in our affinity for confident people. So here's the answer to the Mindset Mastery Quiz, the Carnegie Mellon study. The major factor for professionals earning the trust of others, you guessed it, the confidence of the professional. Simple, confident explanations trump expertise. Mirror neurons and energy fields resonate with another's emotional state and influence behavior. This is what we know. Confidence is more correlated with success than competence or expertise. Confidence is what initially engages someone. It's what people will pay you for, although they're going to consciously think it's for other reasons. Since we know that confidence is a significant predictor and determinant of success, be aware of conscious and unconscious biases. For example, in studies with business school graduates, men initiate salary increases 40% more than women do. And when both ask, women ask for 30% less than men. At Manchester Business School in England, Professor Marilyn Davidson said, "I've been doing this for 7 years, and every year there are massive differences between the male and female responses. The male students expect to earn significantly more than the women. And when you look at what the students think they deserve to earn, again, the differences are huge. You can never earn more in the outside world than you can earn in your own mind. If you earn 10% more or less than that income thermostat in your mind, that default mode, you may automatically and unconsciously engage in automatic behaviors and patterns to reestablish the status quo, the default mode, to move the thermostat back to the set point. You have to achieve it in your mind to change the thermostat before you can achieve it in reality. But once something unconscious becomes conscious, it's no longer unconscious. We always present in a manner consistent with our self-concept, just as we do in any other role that we play. A self-concept regulates every aspect of our lives. Confidence is a state of mind that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. For example, if you do everything except close a discussion by making a specific professional recommendation to a client about your services and your fee, in a confident way, in a clear, specific way, your self-concept in that area needs to be addressed. The professional must always maintain the initiative. You've never heard other professionals like doctors or attorneys say something wishy-washy like, "Well, do you think it would be helpful for us to work together?" The professional makes a specific, confident recommendation. You don't let the guy with a shovel decide how many elephants are in the parade. So, when is the best time to make a sale? Is it after a vacation and you're relaxed? When you have debt? Or when you're in a dry spell and really need to? No. The best time to make a sale is right after a sale. Confidence is a state of mind. It's contagious. Sustaining an optimum state is as important as changing a negative state. And consider this from the prospect's point of view. What's the major thing that holds the prospect back from making a purchase? Is it fear of making a mistake? Concern of not getting value? Worry of paying too much? Question of not being able to use the product or service? The major thing that holds the salesperson back is the fear of rejection that the prospect may say no. Two simple practical applications from the mind and brain sciences. Anything you do to avoid the possibility of being rejected ensures it. Remember, we get what we focus on. the major thing that keeps you from getting what you want is your story about why you can't have what you want. So just a brief overview of what we touched on before of conversational intelligence, and then there's some aspects of a mastery model that I'm going to dictate to you and also post on that page. Neuroscientists show us that the first few words of a conversation boots up a particular mindset in the listener to process the remainder of the conversation. A conversation that begins with authoritative, critical, or adversarial remarks, or ones that are perceived in that way, activates the brain circuitry of fight and flight. The reaction is processed by the cortisol, adrenaline neurochemical system, and the listener becomes careful or guarded. A conversation that begins in a collaborative, collegial way activates the brain's neurochemical system of bonding and connection and induces listening without judgment to pay full attention. Those first few words boot up the mindset that creates the neurochemical system that then processes the remainder of the entire conversation. The listener then, with this collaborative mode mediated by the chemical system of oxytocin, the chemical of bonding connection, the listener feels safe and understood. Trust develops with further collaboration to optimize performance and results. Your opening remark determines whether the prospect will listen to you. It needs to be planned word for word. In the first 10 words, people decide whether they're going to listen to you or not. So don't begin with, well, here's how I'd answer that. You've already used 7 words, so you've only got 3 left. All successful sales are based on one factor, a relationship. People don't buy from people they don't like, and people can't sell to people they don't like. Enthusiasm accounts for more of sales closing ability than any other factor. The transfer of enthusiasm changes the state of the other person. Confidence begets enthusiasm. The key to developing an effective engagement is twofold. To know and resonate with the prospect's need, the essential challenge. To know your unique proposition, what you do better than anyone else. What is it that's unique and special about your product or service in 10 words or less? People won't buy your product because it's as good as everybody else. They'll buy because it's unique in some way for them. Your key job is to identify that unique advantage that sets you above everyone else and build your comments around that. Hint at the results. Plant a seed of the benefit in your first question. Focus on the key benefit that the prospect will enjoy. Not what you've done, not your experience, not how long you've been doing what you're doing, not your credentials, but what the prospect needs. When you ask a question, people are conditioned to respond to the question before they respond to anything else. Make sure your question is focused on the benefit that you bring to their problem. So, I'm gonna finish by a discussion with a story about mindset and the circle of persuasion. Imagine your audience is a person you're trying to persuade. To visualize this challenge, draw a stick figure to represent the person. We did this just a little bit in the first time. Next, draw a big circle around the stick figure. So that divides the world into two parts. Someone who understands the world the way the stick figure does, who's outside the circle, someone who understands the world the way the stick figure does belongs inside the circle, next to the stick figure. People who don't understand the way the stick figure does belong outside the circle. And to get the stick figure to listen to you, you're going to have to enter that circle. The stick figure is your prospect. So your first job is to get into the circle. The challenge is this. If your prospects don't see you as belonging in that circle, they're probably not going to listen. Your point of view won't be seriously considered. You'll remain an outsider with little influence. So to enter, identify your prospect's biggest challenge. Resonate with that experience. Articulate the challenge or pain points as clearly as you can to move into the circle. Listen carefully. Identify the kinds of emotions your prospects feel. Then put yourself in their shoes and ask why they're feeling that way, the specific challenges. See what they see. Feel what they feel. And then find some part of their emotional experience that you can genuinely resonate with. You have to resonate with your audience, with where they are, and find a way to communicate that understanding before they're going to admit you to their circle. Here's a description of how the circle technique works. This was a Wall Street Journal reporter who followed Obama winning presidential primaries, and people were puzzled about how he was charming voters in the heartland. Reporter Stephen Hayes followed Obama around and analyzed his circle strategy. When he addresses a contentious issue, Mr. Obama almost always begins his answer with a respectful nod in the direction of the view he's rejecting, a line or two that suggests he understands or perhaps even sympathizes with the concerns of that person. Remember what Lincoln did. He moves into the circle. This was Lincoln's approach to arguing the case. He cited an example in which Obama was asked about the Second Amendment. He began his answer by saying that, having taught constitutional law for 10 years, he believed that the Second Amendment granted individuals the right to carry guns, the conservative position, and that he respected the right of lawful gun owners to hunt to protect their families. Only then, after he was in the circle, did Obama go on to talk about how he thought there should be new laws to help trace firearms used in crimes. At the end of his answer, Obama employed one final circle move, kicking his opponent out. He said, "The argument I have with the NRA is that they believe any constraint or regulation whatsoever is something that they have to beat back. And I don't think that that's how most lawful firearm owners think." So, Obama is left standing next to the lawful firearm owners, his audience, inside the circle, while the NRA has just been declared bereft of common sense, not like us, cast out of the circle. Winning means not only getting inside, it also can include overtly or covertly pushing your opponent out. I don't recommend doing it overtly. The circle vision suggests that to bring the audience to your side, your first move is to go where your audience is. Connect with your audience, then you can move forward together. Here's a very simple example. A Girl Scout variation of entering the circle. Most Girl Scouts are taught to memorize a fairly complicated spiel, one that involves introducing themselves, talking in detail about the good work that the Scouts do, and finishing with how the money raised goes for great purposes. Now, this is tough work even for a professional, but a kid talking to an adult stranger can be scary. There's one alternative that more than doubles the sales rate. It's the question, instead of all this stuff, what's your favorite kind of Girl Scout cookie? Questions focus our brains, and the first few words determine a state of mind. In 10 words or less, all the nostalgic memories of cookies past are summoned in one simple question. The power and the transaction shift with the Girl Scout going from requesting to supplying. It's a question that avoids a no, a question that starts a conversation, and a question that opens the door to emotion. These are the kind of questions that create value and build careers. The experience from the buyer's point of view is an emotional connection to something that's been in his or her life since being a kid. And there's a reason they don't change the flavors, which is a positive reaction to a young person also learning to speak up. Selling is a state of mind that far, let me say that differently. Selling a state of mind far outpaces only selling Thin Mint cookies. So here's a summary then of mastery mindset, and then I'll go on to take some questions and comments. And this summary is in your outline. People buy for emotional reasons and justify with logic. Emotions drive us. Find the emotional reasons for buying now. Find the logical reasons then for buying now. The purpose of a conversation, written or spoken, is to find the prospect's needs and mutually create conviction. Conviction starts with you first, then the project, then the prospect. Selling is the transfer of emotion. For someone to buy, they must feel certain they're going to get what they want. When two people interact, the person with the greatest confidence will influence the other. People have to buy for their reasons, not yours. Facilitate the prospect's conviction that they will get what they want out of your service or product by matching their core identity. Find the predominant emotional reason for buying. Remember, they'll translate it into their logical reason. That's their internal conversation. For brain processing, do one feature at a time, not the whole list. The authentic connection and how you say what you say will make more difference than what you say. And finally, consistently focus on prospects' benefits, values, and avoiding pain. So, questions, thoughts? I know we've gone a little bit more, but I want to be sure that we have enough time for any questions or comments that you have. And remember the two things that I mentioned that will be posted. Give me 36 hours to dictate and send it to my IT guy and post it on the portion of the outline that I didn't cover. I'll dictate from that and post it so you'll have the access to that. Questions?
Thank you. Dave, thank you for tonight's session. As people are queuing up for questions, folks, you can press *5. And I'll be able to see that you've got a question, and I can unmute your phone. In the meantime, I want to thank Dave for a great session tonight and remind everyone that we'll be back here a week from today on February 6th for the fourth session at 7 p.m. The recording of tonight's session will be posted on the class page within 24 to 48 hours. At the conclusion of the February 6th event, we will send you a survey, and we would love to get your feedback on this series as well as ideas that you have for future professional development events. So please take some time and fill out the survey. At the end of it, if you'd like to generate a CEU credit, you can use the code MINDSET, MINDSET, in small letters, MINDSET, for tonight's session. So if you have some questions, please hit *5 and I'll be able to call on you and you can ask Dave some questions.
While you're thinking of questions, if I'm not interrupting anybody, here's an example, a very quick illustration of how you want to be very specific in your question, in what you ask for. A woman applied for a job in sales. The man she was interviewing pushed his laptop over to her and said, "Sell me this." So, she closed the laptop and walked out. He couldn't find her anywhere. Finally, he found her cell number from an application. He called her and said, "Bring my laptop back." And she said, "$400 and it's yours."
Nice, Dave. Good example. I don't see any questions yet in the queue. And, Dave, I know at the beginning of the session you might have some from your email you wanted to cover briefly.
One is to think about very simple responses to make ideas easier to understand. Listen to people's challenges. Don't assume what they know or what they believe. And connect to something that the listener already understands. This is one way of entering the circle, to resonate with an experience that you understand, a challenge that you hear. Use the most simple, basic language possible. And remember, when you ask questions or have conversations, remember those four basic principles of good speaking and good writing. clarity, brevity, simplicity, and humanity. And I didn't go into, I went into earlier, not this seminar, some of the reasoning and the research behind the 10-10 principle, that our minds and our brains actually retain up to 10, maybe at most 12 words, and then we begin to tail off. We don't quite absorb it as much. We don't remember it quite as much. And in research, a buddy of mine, Mark Waldman, and I touched on this before, has done some research to find that when we use 10 words or less, things get understood, resolved, and there are greater perceptions of benefits in research situations like divorce, mediation, arbitration, things that are emotionally charged. When each side agrees to stick to only 10 words, those emotionally charged situations are resolved in a third of the time that it usually takes, and are resolved in a much more satisfactory way. And I wanted to reiterate that from an earlier time, because I think it's so important that our brain learns in small chunks, in 10 to 12 words. And one other thing partly in response to a question. People change their behavior only when they recognize the benefit of doing so for themselves. It won't work if it's for your reasons. It won't work if it's what you think are benefits and features and that sort of thing. Concentrate on engaging and prompting insight rather than giving facts or instructions or models. So it's all about your client, your prospect, your customer. Begin with where they are and go someplace new together. I know we're essentially out of time. Feel free to email me, and if there are some questions or comments that we haven't addressed, that I haven't addressed, then I'll begin with those next time. dkruger@mentorpath.com. So I look forward to our final seminar on neuromarketing, and we're going to bring together some things that we've been talking about for more specific application for neuromarketing aspects of your practice, your products, your coaching firm for most of you. So thanks very, very much for all of your attention, energy, kind words, and responses and emails. I welcome them. Thanks.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Dave. Good night, everyone.